This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Jonathan Steinberg, speaking with us today about the life and works of Otto von Bismarck. Jonathan, you've written a new biography of the Iron Chancellor, and you present it as the story of a sovereign self. How does it come to pass that the statesman responsible for the invention of Germany and the making of 19th century Europe enjoyed the freedom to do as he pleased?
Well, you need a little institutional background for that. It was still a semi-absolute monarchy, and his power rested absolutely on his relationship with the king. He had a public of one, and for 26 years, that public was faithful to him through every conceivable kind of scene, hysteria, doing things that the king didn't want to do, that his family did not want the king to do. Bismarck was loathed by the Empress Augusta, by the Crown Prince Frederick, by the Crown Princess Victoria, and a lot of the court. But the king always stuck by him. And I think he stuck by him because he knew that Bismarck was something really, really special and would do whatever the king wanted in the end, even if it was his own way. It's a unique situation. Could not happen again. He had no political party, never had one. He was not a very interesting speaker. And if I may, I'd like to quote a newspaper account in the 1880s when Bismarck was at the height of his power by the Schwäbische Merkur, describing his speaking technique. "How astonished are those who hear him for the first time. Instead of a powerful, sonorous voice, instead of the expected pathos, instead of a fiery tirade glowing with classical eloquence, the speech flows easily and softly in conversational tones across his lips, hesitates for a while, and winds its way until he finds the right word or phrase, until precisely the right expression emerges. One almost feels at the beginning that the speaker suffers from embarrassment. His upper body moves from side to side. He pulls his handkerchief from his back pocket, wipes his brow, puts it back again in the pocket, and pulls it out again." I mean, this is not the performance of a charismatic orator. And indeed, until
Disraeli said of him that he speaks the way Montaigne writes.
One of my favorite quotes. He was the most fascinating conversationalist. People were enchanted by him. He was mesmeric, absolutely incredible. General von Stosch said of him, "It's again an enchantment to see the imperial chancellor in full spiritual activity. His flights of thought can become quite striking when the task of defending the empire against Prussian particularism falls upon him."
Give us some dates. He's born when, and he comes to power at what age?
Yeah. He is born on the 1st of April, 1815, which from a historical point of view is an absolutely perfect moment to be born, as it were, because on the one hand, it's the end of the Napoleonic period in the French Revolution, and it's the beginning of the long 19th century, which comes to an end when the First World War breaks out. He dies on the 30th of July, 1898, at the age of 83. By the time he died, he was an icon. Everywhere he went, he was the great Bismarck of history. But the reality is that when Bismarck was appointed in September of 1862, he had a reputation of being an absolutely crazy reactionary, completely untrustworthy. The previous king, Frederick William IV, had said of him, "Bismarck, only to be used when the bayonet rules without limit." So that was his reputation.
And his tradition is Prussian. Yep. What does that mean?
Prussian is hard to describe. In a way, it's easy for Americans to understand it because there was a large gentry class, landowning class, from which Bismarck came. He was Otto von Bismarck Schönhausen, and that was the name of the estate, Schönhausen, which his family inhabited. They were very, very strict evangelical Protestants, most of them. Many of them actually very similar to the evangelical movement we have here. They did not go to church. They celebrated Mass in the fields. They were profoundly, profoundly puritanical in all sorts of ways. And it was in this world that Bismarck was born. He was certainly not one of them, and he didn't behave like one. But in due course, he came, in a sense, to power because he could do something that they couldn't. He could say things and design things and influence people in a way that even the highly placed evangelical Protestants couldn't do. One of them, Leopold von Gerlach, was the personal adjutant of the King Frederick William IV, and that basically was Bismarck's route to power. When the evangelicals liked him, when he thought they were useful, he was an evangelical. And later on in the 1870s, after he'd unified Germany and set up the German Empire, he turned to the liberals and used them for a while and dumped the evangelicals. So there is in Bismarck a certain absolute ruthlessness about using people. And they all say that. I mean, lots and lots of quotes in the book about people who know they're being used and will be discarded when he's finished with them. But because he's so great, they put up with it.
He's brilliant. Describe his physical characteristics, his size.
Yeah. You get different accounts of him. The general view is he must have been at least 6'4". He was very, very broad-shouldered. As a young man, he had very bright blue eyes and sort of sandy hair. As he got older, he got very fat. And I've got a wonderful quote. In fact, I think maybe my favorite quote in the whole book. This is 25 January 1875, and it comes from a young man named Christoph Tiedemann, who later on became Bismarck's first personal private secretary. He was a deputy in the parliament, a national liberal, an unexceptional, you know, decent guy, but somehow Bismarck found him and liked him and hired him. So this is an account of his first day at the Bismarcks. And I want to say that Bismarck was married to a woman who absolutely refused to be a society lady. She never put on fancy clothes. They always dined at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which is extremely unfashionable, and hardly ever had state dinners. Disraeli was among the very, very few who actually went to one of these private meals. So Tiedemann writes up in his diary the following. 25 January 1875, an interesting day, from 5 to 11 in the Bismarck house. The prince complained about poor appetite. Hats off, I'd like to see him once with a good appetite. He took second helpings from every course and complained about ill treatment when the princess protested energetically against the enjoyment of a boar's head in aspic. He sipped the wine but drank lots of beer from a large silver tankard. About 7:30, the prince invited Zirbel, his famous historian, and me to follow him to his study. As a precaution, he offered us his bedroom, which was next to the study, as a place to relieve ourselves. And this, by the way, is an insight into 19th-century plumbing. We went in and found under the bed two objects, which we sought, of colossal dimensions. As we stationed ourselves at the wall, Zirbel spoke seriously and from the depth of his heart. Everything about the man is great. Even his blank.
So he has a gargantuan appetite and a gargantuan bowel movement and a gargantuan ambition and drive for power. Yeah. He comes to power in 1862.
Let me just, before I do that, quote one more bit from Tiedemann, because this tells you the other side of it. Bismarck had a fantastic ability to work. This is some years later. Tiedemann writes in his diary a typical work session with Bismarck at one of Bismarck's country houses. Yesterday, I spent 2.5 hours in his study. Today, he dictated the whole afternoon a letter to the emperor in all 32 folio sides, not interrupted, but written right through. He gave not only an exact account of the negotiations with Bennigsen about his joining the cabinet, but at the same time a highly political account of the development of our entire party system since the introduction of the Constitution. The prince dictated without stopping for 5 hours. I repeat, 5 hours. He spoke more quickly than usual, and I could hardly keep up with the flow of thought. The room was overheated. Bismarck always had his rooms overheated, and I began to sweat terribly and thought I might get a cramp. I decided quickly, without saying a word, to take off my jacket and threw it over a chair. I continued in shirt sleeves. The prince, pacing up and down, looked at me first in amazement, but then nodded at me with understanding and continued without pause to dictate.
But it's the strength of his personality, what you call the sovereign self, because he rules with the approval of the king, but he has no parliamentary power. He's not a general. Nope. He's not an emperor.
Nope.
And yet he's in the grand tradition with Frederick the Great and Napoleon.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in terms of his achievement, it is greater than either Napoleon's or Frederick's. Frederick was a king, a genius also. Napoleon was a general and had a revolutionary army to command. Bismarck had none of these things. And what fascinated me, where my biography, I think, differs from all the previous ones, ask, what did Bismarck do? How did he unite Germany? What were the consequences? What were his legislative acts and so on? I'm interested in the question, how he did it? Because he had no assets going for him except the fact that he was really, really smart. And I think there are two moments in his career which are really characteristic. One is, and this is, I think, interesting for Americans. He met at Göttingen an upper-class Bostonian, John Lothrop Motley, and they became really good friends. And I think it's fair to say that Motley was Bismarck's closest friend. Bismarck learned to speak really good English with Motley and read lots of English literature. And Motley saw in Bismarck a very, very ruthless figure. And I'd like just to read this little bit, if you have the patience, because it comes from the 17-year-old Bismarck, not the Bismarck of history. This is the account that Motley gives. He's walking through the streets of Göttingen, and he sees this extraordinary character challenging everybody in sight to duels and behaving like an absolute idiot. They go back to his room. There, and the interesting thing about this is Motley went home and at the age of 25 himself wrote a novel about his 24-year-old friend. And I ask my students, how many of you know anybody so remarkable that you would write a novel about him? And here I think is one of the key moments in the whole of Bismarck's, the material on Bismarck. "There," said Robin Mark, entering the room, unbuckling his belt, and throwing the pistols and sword on the floor. Quote, "I can leave my buffoonery for a while and be reasonable. It's rather tiresome work, this gaining reputation. I'm a Fox freshman. When I came to the university 3 months ago, I had not a single acquaintance. I wished to introduce myself into the best Landmannschaft dueling society, but I saw little chance of doing that. What course do you suppose I adopted to gain my admission?" And he explains how he cut up everybody possible. This is, I think, the real essential Bismarck. "I determined at once, on arriving at the university, that to obtain mastery over my competitors, who were all extravagant, savage, eccentric, I had to be 10 times as extravagant and savage as any of them. I intend to lead my companions here as I intend to lead them in afterlife. You see, I am a very rational sort of person now. You would hardly take me for the crazy mountebank you met in the street half an hour ago."
But he insisted on dominating people. Yeah, he could absolutely be very abusive. He had a scornful idea of the human race.
Yep.
I mean, and lost them. All of his friends, and yet manages to force through his policies over a period of 28 years.
Yep, absolutely.
Before we get to the sort of a summary at the end of your book, tell us about what are his political, strategic, geopolitical accomplishments between, say, 1862 and 1890?
They're amazing. He took the second of the German states, not the most powerful nor the most prestigious, and he transformed it into the German Empire, the greatest power on the continent of Europe, and the one which, in effect, held the whole world at bay for the first half of the 20th century. I mean, after all, it's Bismarck's Germany which fights the First World War, and it's basically the same institutions and structure which fights the Second World War. So Bismarck created modern Germany. He fought 3 wars to do it. First, he picked a fight with the Danes. That was quite a tough struggle. He won, and that allowed him to gain the prestige to deal with the domestic crisis that he had. Bismarck got appointed because the king was desperate. There was a constitution, there was a parliament, and the king had decided that the army absolutely had to be reformed. There needed to be longer service, there had to be more money, but he would not allow the parliament to interfere in the running of the army. The king was, in many ways, a very reasonable man, but he was commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That was his royal duty, and no parliament composed of liberals was going to get in his way. It got to the point at which the conservatives had only, I think, 10 seats in the parliament. The whole parliament was full of liberals baying for the king's head. The king was about to abdicate. And here we come to somebody who was crucial in the story, and I think one of my most important realizations is what he meant. This is a general called Albrecht von Roon, and he met Bismarck when Bismarck was 17. He hired Bismarck and his friend Moritz von Blankenburg to help him with surveying a particular territory in Brandenburg for the Prussian army, and he knew that Bismarck was special. So when he was appointed Minister of War in 1859, he said to the king, "You must have Bismarck." And he said it all the time until the crisis got so acute that the king was facing either abdication or appointing Bismarck. And he appointed Bismarck.
And is that the Blood and Iron speech?
That's the Blood and Iron speech. That is his most famous speech, and it was a fiasco. His first public appearance, he goes to the finance committee of the lower house of the Prussian parliament, and he makes this speech. "The great affairs of the day," I'm quoting from memory, "will not be decided by speeches and majority resolutions. That was the great mistake of 1848, but by blood and iron." Which, of course, for the whole of the parliament and much of public opinion, confirms their fear that Bismarck is just a crazy reactionary.
Go quickly, Jonathan, Austrian and then the French war.
So then there are 3 wars, the Danish War, the Austrian War, which again is a very important, it unifies Germany to the mine, and then the Franco-Prussian War. Now, of course, Bismarck did not control the army for a minute. and he was very lucky. In 1857, the king appointed
Boris. But he insisted on dressing in his uniform.
He always wore a uniform, yeah, to which he largely was not entitled. But I think the other thing, Lewis, is that he had a genius as chief of the general staff. Helmut von Moltke was probably one of the greatest generals of modern times. So the tool which he had to use to unite Germany was brilliant. It operated on the railroads, it caught the enemy by surprise, and they won two wars in about 6 weeks each. So that was not his achievement, but he used it.
His power comes to an end when the king dies and is succeeded by his son in 1890. And what then is the legacy that Bismarck leaves? He becomes a legend and an icon.
Yep.
And how does that play down through the years into modern Germany?
I think there are a variety. This is quite controversial. I don't think that this is the one bit that Mr. Kissinger, when he reviewed this book in the New York Times, really did not like. But I think, and I've got supporting evidence, that what Bismarck did was to flatten the political parties. They became dependent on the idea that there's a genius up above who will decide everything for us. And that, I think, left a vacancy when the Kaiser, the grandson, takes over. The Kaiser tries to fulfill this role. He's unable to do it. When the war breaks out, the whole system collapses. It becomes a military monarchy. Then you have the Republic. And even in the Republic, one of Bismarck's generals becomes president. And it's that kind of substitute Bismarck figure who is in power in 1933 and appoints Hitler. So I don't think Kissinger misunderstood me. I don't for a minute think that Bismarck was like Hitler. But I think his legacy left a gigantic void at the center of German politics. Another genius statesman was needed, and that, unfortunately, was Hitler.
Most of the historians write about the legend and the legacy, but they omit what you call the real Bismarck, the violent, intemperate, hypochondriac, misogynist.
Yeah, all that.
What was his hypochondria? I mean, a man of great strength and brutality.
He was tremendously hypochondriac. I mean, he had every conceivable kind of imaginary diseases. The speech which the Schwäbische Merkur covered, a couple of days later he told one of his secretaries, "Do you know, the stenographers weren't taking down my speech properly. That's why I felt sick. I felt dizzy, like when you smoke too much." I mean, all the time. I have theories about this, which I probably will, they're in the book. I think he was, oddly enough, very, very insecure. His mother had never given him the kind of maternal care that he really needed all his life. He was always looking for it. And he was both hypochondriac and gluttonous and always putting himself to bed. I did a calculation of 1,200 days in the years 1877 to 79, about 60% of them. He was away from Berlin, and a lot of that time in bed with diseases.
Jonathan, comment at the end on one of your summation remarks. You say his skill had no purpose other than to prop up antiquated royal semi-absolutism and to satisfy himself. The means were Olympian, the ends tawdry and pathetic.
I'm afraid that is my conclusion. What was he doing? He was propping up an antiquated form of semi-absolutist Hohenzollern monarchy, not something that you take to the barricades about. It was an old system of government. He needed it. Without it, he could not have exerted his power. He had no power to command anybody unless the king gave it to him. So in the process of exercising his tremendous urge to dominate and to transform things, what he bequeathed to the 20th century was this very, very rickety old machine, and he couldn't get it to work. As he went on, it worked less and less well for him, and by the time he fell from power, it was actually coming to a halt. It just did not work. And under his successor, Kaiser William II, it really ceased to work at all. So the machinery which he set up was just designed, in effect, for him to rule.
Thank you, Jonathan Steinberg, for speaking with us today about Otto von Bismarck and the making of modern Europe. I'm Louis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.